Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On everything from COVID to levelling up, Prime Minister Boris Johnson's lies and empty promises dragged the country deeper into the mire. The opinion article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist John Harris. The piece is titled, Boris Johnson's Crises Boil Down to One Thing. Contempt for the rest of us. The word contempt, I learned last week, is derived from the Latin contemptus, meaning scorn. My 2008 edition of the Oxford English Dictionary defines it as the feeling that someone or something is worthless or beyond consideration. A more recent article in the magazine Psychology Today says that empathy and contempt are polar opposites, and warned that the latter always has a catastrophic effect on human relationships. I was researching the word because of its increasingly regular use in headlines relating to the Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Last Thursday, a column in the Financial Times was titled, Carelessness and Contempt are at the root of every Boris Johnson crisis. Over the previous few weeks, a writer in the Daily Telegraph has scolded Boris Johnson for his contempt for business, while The Economist has accused him of treating checks and balances with contempt. Boris Johnson has also been accused of having contempt for NHS staff, former coal mining communities, his fellow MPs, and the population of Wales. It is rare that a week goes past without some or other story about this element of his personality and politics and the C-word being used. There are two elements to all of this. One is Boris Johnson's Trumpish disdain for some of the most basic components of our democracy. The rule of law, scrutiny of the executive branch, and an independent BBC, which he is now lashing out at yet again. The other is bound up with the Prime Minister's apparently dim and disrespectful view of his fellow human beings, which, as revelations about Downing Street parties pile up, is now at the heart of our politics. The latest story, broken by the Sunday Mirror, has its own specific details. Boris Johnson on a computer screen merrily asking quiz questions, while his staff huddled by computers, knocking back wine and beer in defiance of restrictions on social mixing. But one very familiar element is present and correct. Whatever privations the rest of us were enduring, says one source, the Prime Minister turned a blind eye. He seemed totally comfortable with large gatherings. This kind of contempt is there in Boris Johnson's serial untruths. Lying, after all, often implies disdain for whoever the liar thinks can be misled. It is part of his strident ambition, an apparent habit of contemptuously using people and causes for his own ends. His Peppa Pig speech at the Confederation of British Industry, CBI, was a case study in contempt for an audience. It is impossible, moreover, to separate this behavioural contempt from the disregard Boris Johnson shows for conventions and institutions, because they ultimately boil down to the same thing, captured in the cliché of rules being for the little people. Remember what a teacher at Eton wrote to his father in 1982. Boris sometimes seems affronted when criticised for what amounts to a gross failure of responsibility. I think he honestly believes that it is churlish of us not to regard him as an exception, one who should be free of the network of obligation which binds everyone else. A justified report, of course, would be that this is the exact mindset that Eton is designed to produce. But even in that context, Boris Johnson seemed to be in a league of his own. In ordinary times, a Prime Minister like that would be problematic enough. But in the midst of the apparently unending COVID crisis, the impression of arrogance and impunity that seems to have spread from Boris Johnson to his aides and cabinet colleagues now feels actively dangerous. As evidenced by the government responding to the spread of the Omicron variant with what it calls Plan B, people are still being told to follow unprecedented rules and guidelines, and a more stringent Plan C may soon follow. If politics and power were the right way up, those at the top would at least do an impression of being serious and consistent in order to rein in any irresponsible parts of the population. But in England, we seem to have ended up with the exact opposite, a dutiful public blogging at a clique at the top who are, to coin a currently ubiquitous phrase, taking us for fools. Shallow, reckless, and apparently contemptuous of the sacrifices people are still making, which will soon enter their third year. Even now, with Labour Party suddenly pulling ahead in the opinion polls and speculation mounting about Thursday's by-election in Shropshire, do Boris Johnson's colleagues really understand how toxic this is becoming? The idea of the government smugly ignoring rules and obligations that apply to the rest of us is surely starting to define perceptions of much more than COVID restrictions. What, for example, of levelling up? The Prime Minister's broken promises about the future of high-speed rail have been widely portrayed as a fatal blow to the credibility of the whole idea. So far, the most visible aspects of the policy have centred on haughtily insisting that places compete for relatively trifling amounts of money. When the delayed levelling up white paper finally appears, it will reportedly include plans to create U.S.-style governors of English counties, but no new spending commitments. The Red Wall, it is safe to say, is not yet aflame with excitement. For all the hype surrounding levelling up, the absence of any emotional connection with or serious plans for the places the government says it wants to help is striking. Once again, the overwhelming impression is of contempt and condescension, and people being blithely offered something Boris Johnson has no serious intention of delivering. Worse still, as proved by the national insurance hike, the end of the universal credit uplift and his regressive plans for funding social care, things that he actually has done will make lives in so-called left-behind places even harder. As governments often do, Johnson and his colleagues doubtlessly thought such moves would cause momentary upset before sitting into irrelevance. The problem with taking us for fools' narrative is that it provides a catch-all context into which these things, along with the controversies about Tory MPs' second jobs, snugly fit. There are presumably people in the cabinet, let alone on the Tory backbenchers, who are starting to yearn for a style of government that might be more serious, more substantial, and mindful of the lives of ordinary voters. Their problem, perhaps, is that once their party decided to once again draw its top brass from the alumni of English public schools, the die was cast. David Cameron had his own version of the politics of contempt. What else was austerity? Like Boris Johnson, he had a habit of saying whatever he thought would either get him out of trouble or bring him more votes. Once he had left office, his work for the defunct finance outfit Greensill Capital suggested someone only too happy to wring money out of the advantages that 99% of us could only dream about. But Boris Johnson is surely something else again, so arrogant and thoughtless that he sometimes seems almost immoral. I recently read Sad Little Men, the writer Richard Beard's eloquent book about private schools and the kind of leaders they produce, which shines light on David Cameron and Boris Johnson via his own story of an elite education. In his experience, contempt for the lower orders began with the idea that everyone else was less special and often stupid and blurred into indifference. We saw from car windows to petrol stations and primary schools and bovis homes in which less privileged lives played themselves out, but the hopes and dreams of these people didn't meaningfully exist for us, nor their disappointments and pain. The story of a public enduring the worst effects of the pandemic, while Downing Street partied on, gives those words an awful potency. Somewhere in that sentence, in fact, lies one explanation for both the mess this government is in and the mire the rest of us have been dragged into.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On Friday, a bipartisan group of leading members of the U.S. House Committee on Foreign Affairs passed a bill aimed at restricting Iran's defensive military prowess. The Stop Iranian Drones Act would ban the supply, sale, or transfer of military drones to or from Iran under U.S. law. The bill addresses what the U.S. claims to be the growing threat of Iran's unmanned aerial vehicle program. However, despite gaining self-sufficiency in the arms industry by making great progress in developing and manufacturing a broad range of military equipment in recent years, Iran has time and again proven that its military capabilities are purely defensive in the face of moves by the U.S. and its regional allies, which have been fomenting chaos and tension in the region. Like last month, when the Iranian army intercepted two U.S. unmanned aerial vehicles that had penetrated the country's airspace, giving them a stern warning to stay away from the zone where it was holding massive drills. The ban imposed on the Iranian military drones comes amid ongoing talks over the removal of anti-Iran sanctions between Tehran and the signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal in Vienna. The U.S. has for long tried to tie Iran's military capabilities to the talks. However, the Islamic Republic has repeatedly underscored that its defensive capabilities will be never subject to negotiations. The U.S. also baselessly accuses Iran of conducting drone attacks in West Asia, while Washington has blood on its hands for killing thousands of innocent civilians by conducting drone and air strikes in the region. Also, let's not forget that the United States is the leading exporter of arms in the world. Washington attempts to restrict Iran's defensive capabilities while it sells bombs, drones, and arms to other countries like Saudi Arabia that use them in unjust wars like the one in Yemen to kill innocent civilians. In fact, half of U.S. arms transfers between 2016 and 2020 went to West Asia region, particularly Saudi Arabia, leading to more instability and chaos. The U.S. is also guilty of civilian killings in many war theaters, like in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, from drone strikes to other military action. Rights groups have accused Washington of hiding the real number of civilian casualties and underreporting them. Based on the U.S. military's own assertion, Washington has conducted almost 100,000 drone and air strikes in the West Asia region in the past 20 years, according to a new analysis published by the civilian harm monitoring group Air Wars. The U.S. strikes have killed at least 22,000 civilians across various theaters, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan since 2001. The group says the number could probably be as high as 48,000. The U.S. also assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis in a drone strike near the Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. The two were iconic figures in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. That's while top U.S. diplomats have previously admitted that Washington is responsible for the foundation of the Daesh terrorist group. Days after the brazen act, the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps launched a volley of missiles at a major military base housing American forces in Iraq. Iran denounced the assassination as a state terrorism and vowed to end the American presence in the region as the ultimate act of revenge.
Well, clearly, if one was going to have a completely honest and neutral legal international legal system, no country can stand above it. But we don't have that. And in fact, we have a system where the people who've got the arms and the money make the decisions. So obviously, if we were to say that any time a country used a drone and killed other civilians, there was going to be sanctions. Clearly, those countries that have drones, in particular this country, would have to be sanctioned. But that's simply not going to happen.
Political dynamics in West Asia have been undergoing an overhaul since earlier this year, when U.S. President Joe Biden announced his country will withdraw its troops from Afghanistan following 20 years of war, and Washington's Western allies followed suit. Just this week, U.S.-led forces ended their combat mission in Iraq, switching to advisory roles in the country. The departure of foreign troops comes amid growing anti-West sentiments in the region and a shift in the focus of Washington's foreign policy from West Asia to China and Russia. That has brought the regional countries together to address the challenges facing the region. One instance is Qatar, which had been under a blockade by Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates since June 2017. That went on until January this year, when the quartet agreed to end the diplomatic row. In the meantime, Saudi Arabia and Egypt have appointed new ambassadors to Qatar. Trade and travel links have also been re-established with Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Egypt, but not with Bahrain.
He has noticed that this American support is limited to just maintaining Saudi Arabia as an outpost of military, of U.S. imperial projection and power play in the region. And of course, when this U.S. support were to be removed or to be reduced, Saudi Arabia, as well as the UAE, as well as Bahrain, as Qatar, and Kuwait, they need more pillars to work with. They need more legs to stand on. And one of the best things to do in this region is collaborate and cooperate with the governments already exist and try to bridge the differences that might exist between various countries.
Qatar's emir has traveled to Saudi Arabia and met Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman several times since then. On Wednesday, bin Salman made his first official visit to Qatar since he was named Crown Prince in 2017. A senior official at the Iranian Foreign Ministry says the development of ties and cooperation with the neighboring countries is among the priorities of the new administration in Tehran. Alireza Inayati says trips and negotiations by the Iranian officials in recent months are all proof of that policy. He says Iran has good ties with the Persian Gulf Arab states, including the UAE, Oman, and Kuwait. Inayati heads the Iranian Foreign Ministry's Office for Persian Gulf Affairs. He was speaking with the Iranian Arabic news channel Al Alam. Inayati also said Iran and Saudi Arabia have held four rounds of talks since September to mend their ties and plan more negotiations. He cited progress in the talks, saying they were friendly and constructive. Ties severed between Tehran and Riyadh in 2016. The two have differences on some regional issues, including the Yemen war. For years, the kingdom pursued a confrontational foreign policy toward the Islamic Republic, but it has recently appeared to have changed track.
When it comes down to it, they are two nations that border the Arab Gulf. They are two nations that are in a very strategic area who border the Gulf region, border the Persian Gulf, the Straits of Hormuz. So these all areas that are of a vitally strategic importance. And when push comes to shove, it is them who have to live there, not the United States, not the United Kingdom or the European Union or any of these Western powers. It is the Iranians, it is the Arabs, the Saudis, the Iraqis, the Kuwaitis, the Qataris who have to live in this region, have to find a way to keep on living. This is something that I believe a couple of years ago that the Iranian government already said, and when it comes down to it, this should be a regional decision.
The recent developments in the region signal a paradigm shift in the ties between West Asian countries. The jury is still out on what that would mean for the United States' interests and influence in the region.
Germany has a new chancellor. Social Democrat Olaf Scholz has been sworn in as Germany's new chancellor, ending 16 years of conservative rule under Angela Merkel. Scholz, who is now 63, had served as vice chancellor and finance minister in Merkel's outgoing government. He got 395 votes from lawmakers in the lower house of parliament. Scholz will oversee a liberal left coalition government between the Social Democratic Party, the SPD, the Greens, and the Liberal Free Democratic Party with the FDP. This is the first power-sharing agreement of such a kind in Germany, and the first governing alliance with three parties since 1957. Merkel's final days as chancellor was her 5,860th day in office, falling short of the record set by her late former mentor, Helmut Kohl, by mere 10 days.
Well, the positive is that she kept the German economy strong. Germany is still an export powerhouse. There are signs of a certain weakening, but still its position is very strong. She left very popular, which is very important. Clearly, Germans liked her, steady, somewhat conservative leadership, and she certainly established Germany as the preeminent power in the European Union.
The alliance brings to a close 16 years of rule by Angela Merkel, who chose not to run again. Germany's incoming government has agreed that EU authorities should act more urgently to defend the rule of law, including withholding EU funds if necessary.
I mean, the pressures that are pulling apart the EU are growing. I mean, after Brexit, people became frightened and decided, that maybe leaving the EU was not such a great idea. But now these centrifugal forces are reasserting themselves. The EU is torn between East and West, North and South, but the East European countries are pushing a much more confrontational policy vis-a-vis Russia. They're allying themselves with the United States, and France and Germany are caught in the middle. And they're kind of trapped, and they aren't sure what to do.
The new government has ambitious plans to fight climate change by phasing out coal early and focusing on renewable energy. But their initial priority will be tackling the coronavirus pandemic. Angela Merkel served alongside four U.S. presidents, four French presidents, five British prime ministers, and eight Italian premiers. Her chancellorship was marked by four major challenges: the global financial crisis, Europe's debt crisis, the 2015-16 influx of refugees to Europe, and the coronavirus pandemic. While credited with securing huge European bailouts that saved Greece from crashing out of the Eurozone, it was achieved at a heavy social cost. Merkel was highly unpopular for being the driving force behind bailouts and austerity cuts. The policy made millions of people jobless, plunging them into poverty. Merkel also kept Germany's borders open to hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing the wars in Syria and Iraq. But the policy drew criticism from right-wing politicians. The refugee influx gave a good excuse to far-right groups to fan the flames of Islamophobia. Popular anger also sent the far-right bloc, the anti-immigration AfD, to Parliament in 2017 for the first time since World War II, making it the biggest opposition force. Merkel's government was accused of protecting Germany's vital automobile industry by watering down emissions regulation reforms, and its refusal to advance the 2038 deadline to quit coal energy also irking green activists.
And she's been caught in the middle of a lot of conflicts and has not acquitted herself especially well. And that includes Ukraine and Iran, especially the JCPOA, the 2015 nuclear accord. Germany under Merkel mostly towed the U.S. line and did not get very many rewards for it. They lost business opportunities in Iran, and they have been kind of chained to an increasingly erratic U.S. policy.
Her government also did not play a constructive role after the nuclear deal with Iran in 2015. Germany under Merkel practically followed the maximum pressure campaign of the U.S. against Iran and did not fulfill its obligations under the deal.
The United States withdrew all of its forces from Afghanistan in August in what was widely described as a humiliating pullout after a 20-year futile war. But America has not left the West Asia region at all, as it retains a large number of its forces in this strategic part of the world. Iraq and Syria are two of the regional countries the United States seems very reluctant to leave. The United States invaded Iraq 18 years ago and had 170,000 soldiers there in 2007, before withdrawing them in 2011. It redeployed forces to Iraq in 2014 as the Daesh terrorist group seized Iraqi territory. A large part of the Iraqi population, including resistance groups, consider the U.S. forces as occupiers. America currently has about 2,500 troops and leads another 1,000 foreign forces in Iraq. Pressure has been mounting on Iraqi officials to force the U.S. to pull its remaining soldiers out of the country. The Iraqi parliament voted in January 2020 to expel U.S. forces from Iraq. The vote came amid heightened anti-American sentiments following the U.S. assassination
of Iranian anti-terror icon General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes. The U.S. military on Thursday announced the end of its combat mission in Iraq. But does that genuinely change anything on the ground? The move won't reduce the number of U.S. troops in Iraq. Rather, it will keep the same numbers and, quote, support roles. Why is the United States resisting growing calls for a complete withdrawal?
The objective of the United States in Syria and Iraq is to act on behalf of Israel, strategically, that is, and to create obstacles to the governments of Syria, Iraq, and Iran, and Lebanon, for that matter, because these four nations and important parts within those four nations are, to some extent, allied. They feel themselves under oppression and attack by the United States and its allies.
Many observers believe the U.S. wants to keep its base in Iraq as part of its efforts to maintain its influence in Iraq and try to contain regional player Iran, among other goals. When Daesh began seizing large parts of Iraq and Syria in 2014, the U.S. was widely accused of involvement in the creation of the terrorist group. Some even inside the United States, like former President Donald Trump, said the group was created by the United States. America ironically deployed troops to Iraq and northern Syria as part of its mission to battle the terrorists. There are still hundreds of American forces in northern Syria who refuse to leave as repeatedly demanded by Damascus. This week, the Syrian president's political and media advisor, Bhutina Shaban, said the U.S., under the guise of its anti-terrorism mission, intervened in Syria, occupied parts of the country, and plundered its resources like oil and natural gas.
Well, the U.S. has, against all international law, walked into Syria with its military. And it has destroyed and occupied and stolen the vast majority of the oil resources of Syria in order to prevent it from getting into the hands of the Syrian government, to impoverish the Syrian people and the Syrian government, and to destroy the economy. That's what this is about.
She also denounced the repeated U.S. airstrikes against residential areas, which have caused a large number of civilian casualties over the past years. Shaban said the air raids are a severe violation of the nation's human rights and Syrian sovereignty. She called the continued U.S. military presence in Syria a naked aggression. Before coming into office, U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to end America's forever wars. But unlike Afghanistan, there has been little talk about any U.S. withdrawal from Syria. U.S. officials with knowledge of the Biden administration's plans said recently that the United States would not be pulling out from northeast Syria anytime soon.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kHz, and in southern Africa, via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kHz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today we are going to continue discussing Imam Khomeini's views on armed forces. This time we will focus on the Imam's cautioning of the armed forces against entering political disputes in the country. First, we will give you a general view of armed forces' role in political affairs. Stay tuned, please. Safeguarding territorial integrity and establishment of internal order are the two major duties of armed forces in all countries. However, historical experiences have shown that armed forces have wielded their power for political purposes and transferring power. In such countries, armed forces have played significant roles in political developments. In many cases, they have tried to repel political parties in a bid to turn into the dominant power in the political arena. The interference and influence of armed forces in politics is an index to show how much a ruling system is democratic. Some theorists name two models for militarism and interference of armed forces in politics. The first model is direct interference of armed forces in politics, and the second one is the culture of militarism and discipline as a pattern of dominance and obedience in people's social life. Considering the fact that militarism leads to admiration of war-mongering views in society, it is called as a political and social ailment. Interference of armed forces in politics can be seen in many types of ruling systems. Roosevelt and Eisenhower were two of the American presidents who caused the U.S. armed forces dominate politics. Napoleon Bonaparte of France, too, because the army dominate people's political and social life to the extent that the military were given the mission to make domestic order and social coherence. The theorists who are concerned about armed forces meddling in politics call professionalism of them as an effective way to overcome the problem. They maintain that armed forces meddling in politics has decreased in advanced societies because these forces are engaged in their specialized military affairs. Hence, they let politicians play their own role of administering the affairs of government. Before the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, Reza Khan founded officers' faculty in 13100, decreased military budget to one-third, while increasing the military four times, that is 150,000. Therefore, the military controlled power in the country, as Reza Khan himself was a low-ranking military officer who had seized power through coup d'etat. Militarism and interference of armed forces in politics reached its climax during the rule of Reza Khan's son, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, especially after the 1964 coup. In the post-coup era, particularly in the 60s and 70s, the number of the military increased to 400,000 from the previous 120,000. In view of this, during 5 years, $6 billion were spent for arms purchase. During the struggles of the Islamic Revolution, there was a public demand of preventing the military from interfering in politics. Imam Khomeini repeatedly explained this point in his speeches. In his testament, the Imam strongly prevented the armed forces from interfering in political parties and insisted that this would guarantee the military power of armed forces and their popularity. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, writes in his testament, "My emphatic enjoinment to the armed forces is that, just as one of the regulations of the system is non-interference of the military in parties, groups, and fronts, they should practice it, and the armed forces, including the military, the police, IRGC, Basij, and others, should not absolutely enter any party and group, and should keep away from political games. Thus, they can keep their military power and be immune from intra-group differences. And it is incumbent upon commanders to prevent the individuals under their command from entering parties." Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolimi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The tragedies caused by the Saudi-led war on Yemen are going beyond the casualties of airstrikes and an ongoing blockade. The Yemeni Pediatric Society says the number of infants with birth defects has increased rapidly since the 2015 war that turned Yemen into a testing ground for internationally banned weapons.
The weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition against our country contain prohibited chemicals that directly affect pregnant women and fetuses. That has increased the birth rate of children with cancer and congenital anomalies, especially in the areas that are being continuously bombed, such as Sana'a, Hodeidah, Hajja, and Sada.
Officials say chemical and biological bombs dropped from Saudi warplanes on Yemenis have made Yemen the world's worst epidemic disaster. They're calling for an investigation into recent cases of congenital anomalies.
Since the first day of the aggression, the Saudi-led coalition has used various types of prohibited weapons, including cluster and phosphorus bombs, to target residential and agricultural areas. As a result of environmental contamination, we witnessed a dramatic rise of congenital malformations amongst children. We demand the documentation of the pathological cases caused by these bombs to reveal Saudi Arabia's war crimes.
Infants are suffering difficult conditions in Yemen in the absence of essential medical supplies and healthcare facilities needed for their survival and well-being. Yemeni health centers have been in a dire situation since the start of the Saudi-led war.
As the war goes on, Yemeni children continue to be at the brunt of the death and destruction left behind by Saudi-banned weapons. People here believe that Riyadh has always been violating international law by using cluster munitions in bombing residential areas since it started its deadly war on Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The U.S. is stunned by a devastating storm of tornadoes that ripped through the six states of Arkansas, Illinois, Kentucky, Missouri, Mississippi, as well as Tennessee overnight. Strong thunderstorms triggered dozens of tornadoes that crumbled metal like paper, swatted down concrete buildings, and threw a freight train off its track. Among notable casualties are a candle-making factory in Kentucky, a nursing home in Arkansas, and an Amazon warehouse in Illinois. An Illinois resident explains how he was shocked by the extent of damage after he rushed to his mother's house.
The damage is worse than some of the stuff I've seen in war pictures, so it's pretty intense. You know, it's not anything that I thought when she called me and told me that, oh, all my trees are gone. I got here and I did not expect to see this.
The town of Mayfield in Kentucky was described as ground zero by officials and appeared post-apocalyptic. A restaurant owner says the town's residents have lost it all.
It was just, this is our hometown, and it's just devastating. Everybody's lost everything.
Rescue workers across the middle of the country are combing through wreckage for survivors. Scores of deaths have already been confirmed, and officials warn that the toll is almost certain to rise as they are sifting through the ruins for the missing. President Joe Biden is going to travel to areas affected by what he's described as likely one of the largest tornado outbreaks in the American history.
I'm monitoring the situation very closely since early this morning. This is likely to be one of the largest tornado outbreaks in our history. It's a tragedy. A tragedy.
President Biden also said he would task the environmental agencies to take a look at the specific impact climate change might have had on the deadly tornadoes. A meteorologist says he has rarely seen anything like this tornado storm during his career, spanning four decades.
I was watching the radar last night, and I was saying, wait a second, this is December. How is this happening in December? This is the kind of thing you would only see at the height of the season, you know, March, April, May. I'd never seen anything like this this time of year. I mean, and you hardly ever see something like this in a career.
The tornadoes have left a trail stretching around 370 kilometers. The multi-state disaster has freshened debates about whether climate change had a role to play in triggering these tornadoes, which are believed to be quite unseasonal, and whether a warmer planet would mean the world should expect to see more disasters of the kind.
Afghans say the Taliban takeover of the country has not brought an end to terrorist attacks there. In addition to three large mosque blasts, recently, IED bomb attacks have been continuously taking lives in the capital, Kabul. People say they're worried about such time-to-time bomb attacks, most of which carried out by Daesh.
People thought that bomb attacks will come to an end after the Taliban take over. But we still do not feel safe. We live in the west of Kabul. Here, we witness explosions every week. We ask the Islamic Emirate to take the security seriously.
Yesterday, an explosion hit a civilian vehicle here. Many were killed and wounded. Recently, people have been fearful of roadside and IED bomb attacks. The terrorists place bombs inside buses and everywhere, so people don't dare to take a bus or walk safely.
But Taliban officials have stressed that there is no place for Daesh or other terrorist groups in Afghanistan.
There is no active or observable terrorist group in Afghanistan. The Islamic Emirate has strong control over Afghanistan. No group or individual dares to stand against the Islamic Emirate or threaten the nation. However, there have been sporadic movements under the name of Daesh to create terror, but our forces are following them and will dismantle them soon.
The waves of terror attacks come as the Afghan society is struggling with unemployment, poverty, and hunger. People say they're disappointed being hit by all these catastrophes. On Friday, here in western Kabul, two explosions hit civilian targets, killing two and injuring at least four. The attacks are claimed by Daesh terrorist group. The continuation of such incidents is raising concerns among the people. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
It was only last month when the statements by Lebanon's then Information Minister George Kordahi made headlines. In a televised interview recorded in August, before his appointment as a minister, Kordahi said the war in Yemen was futile and that Saudi Arabia and the UAE were the aggressors in that conflict. But it didn't take long for him to become the target of an unprecedented pressure campaign conducted by Saudi Arabia and its allies. In a bid to ease the tensions, Kordahi decided to leave office, a move he says he did not feel good about in the first place.
When I resigned, I did not feel good about being forced to step down. If Lebanon did not have these current problems and crisis and bankruptcy, I would have no reason to resign. And the government could have opposed my resignation and the whole Lebanese nation would have rejected it. For 40 days, I was under pressure from all sides, forcing me to resign. I resisted for 40 days. I could have resisted for 40 years, but I needed to consider the national interests.
Kordahi says he resigned to put the interests of Lebanese people first, but he says he's surprised at the extent of the influence external players exerted to make him step down.
We have hardly ever seen a government demanding the resignation of a minister or an official in another country, or setting it as a condition where a country has no choice but to comply. This has not happened, but in Lebanon, it is the second time that such a thing is happening. I have not disrespected anyone. 2 months before a ministerial appointment, I said something that was in favor of all parties without hurting anyone. Now I feel I have been oppressed.
The former Lebanese minister says his resignation has been a bargaining chip. The French President Emmanuel Macron has used to open talks with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Throughout the whole interview, Kordahi stresses his firm stance on his previously stated views.
I have borne the cost of my position on the Lebanese resistance and Syria throughout the past 10 years. Today, I also paid the price of my position on Yemen, and I am proud of it. Each media activist is the voice of the people and should not hide the truth.
And when asked if he would retract the statements triggering his forced resignation, he says he would not back down.
I will repeat the same remarks, because I spoke in good faith and did not say anything to offend anyone. This war, the war in Yemen, is an erosive war for both of these countries and all aggressors. Therefore, I demand an end to this years-long war.
Kordahi resigned for criticizing years of devastating war, a war that has taken the lives of hundreds of thousands of Yemeni people, displacing millions and creating a dire situation that is described by the United Nations as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The death of India's Chief of Defense Staff, Bipin Rawat, his wife and 11 others in a chopper crash on Wednesday made big news across the subcontinent. The report went viral on social media and received huge attention region-wide. Following the incident, a female staffer at one of the Kashmir's leading banks received suspension for what they described as, quote, inappropriate reaction to a social media post about the death of the chief of defense staff, unquote. People in Kashmir are criticizing the suspension, saying this is a violation of their rights to free speech.
I am not judging her reaction, but emoji symbols are sometimes sent by mistake, since touch screens are highly sensitive. This is highly undemocratic on the part of Kashmir officials.
In the Indian-administered Kashmir, government offices and semi-government institutions have issued circulars and updated codes of conduct cautioning employees against posting anything critical of India or its rule in the region. Scores of people in Kashmir have removed their social media posts out of fear of police action. A police officer who didn't want his name to be disclosed said that only posts that can attract a lot of attention or encourage disruption of public order are being assessed, since Kashmir is a sensitive region. However, analysts say authorities in Kashmir are trying to control the narrative to justify India's decision to end Kashmir's special status in August 2019.
This is depiction or reflection of sense of insecurity which has overtaken Indian state, because they feel if they allow people to express freely, the reality of Kashmir will get exposed before whole of the world.
India is increasingly using its anti-terror laws since the Hindu nationalist party Bharatiya Janata Party came to power in 2014. In Kashmir alone, over 2,300 people have been booked under the law since 2019, and half of them are still in prison. Global human rights bodies, including the United Nations, slammed India last month for arresting Kashmir's human rights activist Khurram Parvez under its anti-terror law. India has dismissed the UN charges as baseless, but people and analysts say repressive techniques are being used to suppress dissent in Kashmir. Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
As the seventh round of talks aimed at reviving the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA continue in Vienna, Iran's lead negotiator Ali Bagheri Kani says some of the issues raised by his team have been accepted, while others have not.
In the course of the talks that have taken place over the past few days, some of these issues were accepted by the other side and some were not. Therefore, we will have a number of issues alongside previous areas of disagreement, which are not too many, that will form the basis for serious discussions at the level of senior negotiators from Iran and the 4+1 countries.
The new Iranian team says it's asking for the verifiable removal of all post-2015 U.S. sanctions before it goes back to full compliance with the JCPOA. Iran has also asked for guarantees the U.S. would not withdraw from the deal again or impose new sanctions that would impede its implementation.
We have a basic logical red line, an agreement that was finalized in 2015 between Iran and the P5+1. The U.S. withdrew from that deal and now it wants to re-enter. So this agreement is a common basis between the two sides. Therefore, we will definitely not accept anything less than the JCPOA. This will definitely be a red line for Iran.
Meanwhile, European officials warn that time is running out amid claims that Iran's demands are stalling progress.
The Europeans know quite well that issues that are unresolved in the previous draft, or issues within the previous draft that were in violation of the JCPOA, they will have to be fixed and they will have to be corrected. They understand this. And while the Europeans are speaking about the original draft, but they know quite well where things stand.
According to an EU official, talks are advancing logically, while the Russian delegate has pointed out that certain misunderstandings from the previous week have now been resolved, although reaching a final deal will take time and a lot of effort. Homolezki, Vienna.
On Friday, a string of large and smaller school unions held a general strike against the 2022 government's budget law Unionists complain the law, which is expected to be approved by the end of this year, fails to allocate funds.